Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon. Welcome to today's webinar on the subject of ISO 45001. 2018, where we provide an overview of the ISO 45001 standard. Benefits of certification to an occupational health and safety standard, such as ISO 45001, certainly vary by industry, by location, a number of factors. However, some common themes or common benefits include, of course, improving an organization's occupational health and safety performance just by means of implementing and maintaining the standard requirements. The result would be a safer environment in which to do business. So safer for employees, visitors, neighbors, contractors, a safer environment in which to do business would be the output if the standard is implemented and maintained as written. Being able to minimize the risks of production delays would be another benefit of an occupational health and safety certification. Maintaining the requirements of the standard drive improvements in the areas of management commitment and employee engagement as well, if the intent of the standard is being met. Maintaining the requirements of the standard also assists in meeting legal requirements that apply to the organization, as it does represent a framework for identifying those applicable requirements and implementing controls to assist the organization in maintaining compliance with those applicable requirements. In terms of strategic business management, benefits might include meeting stakeholder requirements, improving the organization's public image, and/or providing a competitive advantage. Any of those could potentially be achieved by maintaining the requirements of the standard and by being able to advertise the certification. ISO 45001 is able to be integrated with other business management systems. It can also drive improvements to supplier health and safety performance. And in some cases, there can be additional financial benefits. We already talked about improvements to public image that can drive an increase in business. There could also be possible cost savings for insurance premiums. In some areas, within certain industries, there may be a discount provided for maintaining an occupational health and safety management system or certain certifications. It may make an organization more likely to win a bid for a job by being able to advertise the certification for ISO 45001, especially if competitors do not hold comparable certifications. Those of you who are already somewhat familiar with ISO 45001, this would be a review. But ISO 45001:2018 replaced the OSAS 18001 standard. It defines requirements for establishing, implementing, and maintaining an occupational health and safety management system, which you will see abbreviated in these slides as an OHSMS. The standard itself represents a framework to allow an organization to control its hazards, reduce the risks of accidents, injuries, ill health, and/or downtime, and to continually improve its processes and its operations. The standard was published in March of 2018, and it is a voluntary certification, meaning that there is not a regulatory requirement for organizations to maintain ISO 45001 certification. The standard reflects the Annex SL structure, which has a specific format to make it easier to integrate with some of the other standards, as well as to use common structure and terminology. The Plan, Do, Check, Act model found in the standard is shown on this slide as well. This is a snapshot taken right out of the ISO 45001 standard. Some of the key requirements in ISO 45001 include the Annex SL structure, which we discussed. So from a perspective of being familiar with OSS 18001 and migrating to ISO 45001, which a number of clients did make that change. One of those key changes was the change of the format of the standard, or the changes to the structure and some of the terminology to align with that Annex SL structure. That was one of the key changes that was made. In the ISO 45001 standard, especially compared to OSAS 18001, there is a greater emphasis on leadership. There's actually a whole clause that is new to the standard that assigns specific responsibilities for those in leadership roles to promote health and safety management within the organization and to help ensure the success of the system. Another key requirement in ISO 45001 is for organizations to take a proactive approach to the occupational health and safety hazards and risks. You see this call for proactivity in several requirements throughout the standard, including expanded expectations for organizations to protect the health and safety of workers and interested parties through hazard identification, risk assessment, operational controls, and so on. Standard also focuses on risk management and requires planning and determination of risk to consider both positive and negative. Those would be risks and opportunities, identified issues, as well as the needs and expectations of interested parties. There is also greater emphasis on achieving the intended outcomes. I have that phrase underlined because it is a defined term within the standard. You'll definitely want to familiarize yourself with that definition if you've not already come across it. There's also an emphasis on objectives, measurement, and change. There's a shift in emphasis when it comes to continual improvement, going from improving the management system itself to actually improving the health and safety performance of the organization. There are some changes in the areas of communication and awareness as well, including what is now equal emphasis on external and internal communication and the separation of awareness requirements from competency requirements. There are some prescriptive awareness criteria found in that section of the standard. Overall, there are fewer prescriptive requirements within the standard, including the incorporation of the term documented information instead of documents or records to give organizations a greater level of flexibility in the modern world of recording media. There is an increased prominence of occupational health and safety management within the organization's strategic planning process. And the standard introduces management of change process and requirements. This goes hand in hand with the concept of proactivity we discussed earlier. I'm not going to go through the terms and definitions in today's webinar. They are included in the slides. Some of the key terms I like to emphasize they are found within the standard. You can certainly download a copy of the slides after the webinar from PDR's website. Again, though, you can find these within the standard. What I do want to emphasize within the Occupational Health and Safety Management System definition is the term intended outcomes. So this is found in the note within the definition, and it identifies that the intended outcomes of the Occupational Health and Safety Management System are to prevent injury and ill health to workers and to provide safe and healthy workplaces. So when we were discussing earlier about achieving the intended outcomes, this is what we mean. And you'll see that phrase come up several times throughout the standard and throughout today's slides. Otherwise, we're going to click through these terms, and you're welcome to review them and encouraged to review them on your own time. Getting into a little bit more detail where we can see some of these requirements found in the standard, we'll do a clause-by-clause review of some of the more significant requirements or the more significant changes if we're comparing the two versions of the standard. This is not going to include every clause within the standard, just highlighting some of the key requirements and key changes. Clause 4 houses the context of the organization, and when we look at 4.1, we see the requirement to determine both internal and external issues relevant to the Occupational Health and Safety Management System, and specifically related to its ability to achieve its intended outcomes. So we see that phrase, that term again, about the intended outcomes. So these issues are as relevant to the organization's ability to achieve those intended outcomes. Some issues could have very little to no impact on the organization's ability to achieve them. Others will have a significant potential impact. Understanding the needs and expectations of workers and interested parties requires the organization to determine who those relevant interested parties are, and then what those needs and expectations may be that often translate to requirements of the system. And it's important to remember that we're using the term interested parties, which goes well beyond employees. Determining the scope of the management system is found in 4.3, and we do need to consider those issues identified in 4.1 and those needs and expectations identified in 4.2 when we go to develop the scope. It doesn't necessarily need to include them all in the outputs, but they do need to be considered. Clause 5 is the leadership clause I touched on earlier, where top management is assigned specific criteria or responsibilities, I should say. So top management should, among other things, take on more responsibility for the effectiveness of the management system, the integration of the management system into business processes, the adequacy of resources allocated to the management system, and the communication of the need to conform to the management system requirements at all levels within the organization. Top management is defined within the standard, and that's why that phrase is underlined in my slides. The occupational health and safety policy and the objectives need to be aligned with the organization's strategic direction in support of achieving the system's intended outcomes. So we see that defined term, that underlined term again. The occupational health and safety policy does specifically need to include a commitment to participation, and this is a change when we compare OSAS 18001 to ISO 45001. Organizational roles, responsibilities, and authorities. This clause no longer specifically mentions a management representative. It's up to top management to ensure responsibilities and authorities are assigned and delegated. responsibilities can be delegated, but ultimately it's top management who is held accountable for the management system and its effectiveness in achieving the intended outcomes. In terms of participation and consultation of workers, both of those terms are defined and underlined in my slides. Take a look at those definitions if you're not already familiar. The expectations here are more specific and more prescriptive than in OSESS 18001. So you want to look at those sections and revise your process accordingly. Six point one covers actions to address risks and opportunities. We see some general requirements. The organization is required to determine those risks and opportunities in order to ensure the management system can achieve its intended outcomes, prevent those undesired effects, and continually improve. Risks and opportunities are often related to hazards, legal and other requirements, or any risks and opportunities that can affect the management system's achievement of intended outcomes. Hazard identification is found in 6.1.2.1. This section, for those of you who may be familiar with OSESS 18001, will find the section is more prescriptive. And we do see, again, the expectations for an organization to be proactive in their approach. We're thinking outside of just necessarily the workers themselves, as this can affect people in the nearby area, people at the workplace who are not necessarily employed by the organization or controlled by the organization, perhaps visitors, contractors, work areas, equipment design are some important considerations as well, depending on the organization and the industry. Actual or proposed changes affecting the occupational health and safety management system. Past incidents should be considered as well. And those are just a couple examples to get you started. These two subclauses are similar. The first focuses on risks and the second on opportunities to have a process to assess those risks and opportunities. And it is required that the assessment of risk be documented to be able to provide evidence in the form of documented information. Legal and other requirements are also to be determined. Excuse me. They need to be not only determined, but kept up to date, have timely access to all of the requirements that are identified to be applicable to the organization. And it's not enough to simply make a list of what those requirements are. How do the requirements apply to the organization? What do the requirements require the organization to do? How does it affect them? What is required? And how, if at all, do they affect the organization's hazards and risks? There could be associated communication requirements that also need to be assessed and accounted for. And these legal and other requirements are to be considered, maintained, to be considered in maintaining and improving the management system. 6.1.4 focuses on planning action. This is where we take the issues and risks that have been identified and address them. Address the risks, the opportunities, the legal and other requirements, the emergency situations, the integration, and how effectiveness of the actions will be evaluated. This needs to be done in accordance with the hierarchy of controls, which can be found in Clause 8.1.2, and system outputs need to be considered as well. Improving the occupational health and safety management system and the performance, the occupational health and safety performance of the organization would be done through the objectives. And there are requirements as to how those are planned, determining how they'll be achieved, and have documented information as evidence of having determined these requirements or these points. Specifically, some of these were required in OSAS 18001, some are new. Things like resource needs, specific tasks that need to be completed, a timeline, how the results will be evaluated, things like that. Competence is covered in 7.2, and the standard requires that competency requirements be determined for workers that can affect the performance of the management system, and the competence must be evidenced through documented information. The organization needs to take action as necessary to ensure the competency requirements are met and to evaluate the effectiveness of any actions taken to achieve competency. The Awareness Clause 7.3 identifies specific items that workers need to be made aware of by the organization, including real or potential ramifications of deviating from the management system requirements. External communication was given a greater level of emphasis compared to OSAS 18001 to put it on equal footing with internal communication. So 7.4.3 focuses on the external communication requirements. The organization needs to determine the occupational health and safety management system's relevant information to communicate and the communication requirements. Who will communicate it? To whom? When? How will it be communicated? Is there a deadline? Is there a prescribed methodology? All of those requirements. It is also expected external interested party views, if they are relevant, would be taken into consideration within this activity. I already touched on the concept of documented information earlier in the slides. This is found in 7.5. The clause identifies specific controls that the organization needs to identify related to creating, updating, and controlling documented information, which is a defined term within the standard. Clause 8 focuses on operations. Operational planning and control includes planning actions for established process criteria with sufficient documented information maintained to ensure the process criteria were actually met. There are no significant changes to the hierarchy of controls found in 8.1.2, but 8.1.3 is new. This focuses on management of change. This introduces the concept. It is proactive in nature. The process to be implemented is for controlling planned changes that could affect the occupational health and safety performance of the organization, as well as review and mitigate any negative impacts of inadvertent changes. So this is the concept of assessing the impact of changes prior to actually making those changes and implementing those changes so that controls such as PPE, training, machine guarding, the list goes on and on, but so that those can be implemented either prior to or in conjunction with the change to avoid any negative impacts. We wouldn't want to, for example, install a new piece of equipment and wait till an employee is seriously injured to consider what PPE or machine guarding might be necessary for that piece of equipment. Some examples to get you started might include new products, services, or processes being added, changes to working conditions, changes to equipment, changing legal and other requirements, and so on. Procurement is covered in 8.1.4, and this essentially covers the expectation for having processes and controls specific to outsourced processes to the extent that those processes could affect the occupational health and safety management system and/or the occupational health and safety performance. One of those subclauses covers contractors to identify and control the occupational health and safety risks related to contractor activity. This can be the impact the contractors have on the organization and its workers, but it also works the other way. What impact could the organization and its workers potentially have on the contractors? It specifies that criteria for contractor selection need to be identified, and there should be processes in place to ensure contractor activities do meet the requirements of the occupational health and safety management system. Outsourcing is addressed in 8.1.4.3 to identify controls to ensure that procured materials and/or services also meet occupational health and safety management system requirements and the intended outcomes. Emergency preparedness and response is covered in 8.2, and there are some additional items to be considered in ISO 45001 when we compare it to OSAS 18001. .9.1 covers monitoring and measurement. This includes a requirement to determine, the occupational health and safety management system's relevant monitoring and measurement requirements to evaluate the occupational health and safety performance and the effectiveness of the management system. Internal audit requirements are covered in 9.2. There are some specific factors to be incorporated into the audit program, and also a requirement that the results be reported to relevant managers, workers, and/or their representatives, and other interested parties as relevant. Management review is covered in 9.3, and in ISO 45001, we see some additional inputs and outputs, as well as some revised inputs and outputs for the management system review to be performed by top management. And that is based, again, on a comparison between OSAS 18001 and ISO 45001. Clause 10 covers improvement, and this includes opportunities for improvement to be identified, incidents to be investigated and addressed, corrective actions to be reviewed for effectiveness and have documented information as evidence. And again, we see a requirement, as we did under the internal audit, for results to be reported to relevant workers and/or their representatives and other relevant interested parties. Continual improvement is covered in 10.3. It is required that the occupational health and safety management system continually improve. This includes improving the occupational health and safety performance of the organization to maintain a culture that supports the occupational health and safety management system, utilizing the participation of workers requirements and implement controls that drive improvements, communicate results to relevant individuals as required throughout the standard, and maintain evidence of any actions or improvements made to the management system through documented information so that those can be demonstrated to an auditor or a stakeholder upon request. We won't be going through the annex in today's presentation, but I do want to touch on some related changes or related requirements that are found outside of the standard itself, but do impact occupational health and safety management system requirements. In the IAF mandatory documents, we see two separate applicable documentation requirements. We have the migration to ISO 45001 from OSAS 18001. This was specifically geared towards clients who were migrating from the OSAS 18001 standard, as we discussed earlier. And then the second IAF mandatory document is the application of 17021 to occupational health and safety management systems. Overall, these two documents raise the bar or raise the expectations for performance for an occupational health and safety management system, as does the ISO 45001 standard itself when we compare it to OSAS 18001. Some of the requirements found within these documents that trickle down to our clients are listed here, and I like to highlight them briefly during the occupational health and safety management webinar that we do. One of the requirements is that significant changes be relayed to the certification body in writing as soon as possible. The intent of these significant change notifications is not to wait until the next audit. Some of those changes could impact the audit process and do need to be considered in advance. It is the organization's responsibility to share those changes in a timely manner. There is a prescribed audit timetable in these documents that certification bodies are required to use to calculate audit time, and it is based in part on risk level and also employee count for an organization. So PJR doesn't have its own audit timetable. This is prescribed by the IAF mandatory document. There's a requirement that if top management does not attend the closing meeting, a reasonable excuse for their absence needs to be provided and documented by the auditor. This goes hand in hand with the expectations for top management to be involved and accountable. It's challenging to demonstrate adherence to that requirement if top management does not make themselves available to participate in the audits, especially on a recurring basis. Personnel responsible for monitoring employee health, such as doctors or nurses, are to be made available for interview during audits as well. Again, this comes from the IAF mandatory documents we're discussing here, not a PJR specific requirement. Certification bodies may conduct special audits in response to compliance issues, incidents, and so on, and may even suspend or withdraw certification. We do have this memorialized within our terms and conditions to mirror the requirement spelled out in the IAF mandatory document, or at least to make our customers aware of that potential. Legal compliance violations or gaps could prevent or impede the initial certification process, and objective evidence of capabilities will likely be required. For any organizations pursuing certification for the first time to ISO 45001, rather than the clients that were certified to OSAS 18001 and migrated to ISO 45001, we have clients pursue certification from the start. And I like to just provide a brief overview of what that process looks like so you can know what to expect. If you're pursuing initial certification to ISO 45001, the first step is to obtain a copy of the standard itself. Then there are expectations for establishing the management system documentation to meet the standard requirements. Conduct any training that is required by the standard. Implement the standard's requirements. This includes conducting an internal audit, conducting a compliance evaluation, and conducting a management system review. We want to make sure that they are timed in such a way that the outputs of the internal audit serve as inputs to the management review. So those audits need to take place first so that the results of those audits can be discussed and considered in the management review. You'll need a contract with a certification body such as PJR to conduct the audits. Initial registration consists of a stage one audit and a stage two audit. Any resulting nonconformances need to be addressed before a certificate can be issued. The stage one audit is primarily a documentation review for the management system to evaluate readiness for the stage two audit. The stage two audit is a full system audit of the entire management system. All processes get sampled, all shifts get sampled to assess the effectiveness of the management system in meeting the requirements of the standard. So are the documented framework or documented information audited during stage one, was that effectively implemented? Are you doing what you say you will do in your procedures? And then are the requirements of the standard being met? Any nonconformities need to be resolved prior to certificate issuance, as I mentioned on the previous slide. Once a certificate is issued, it's good for 3 years. You enter into the two following years of surveillance audits. These could be annual or semi-annual in nature, depending on the contract and the preference. Those represent partial system audits, not typically as long as the stage two audit, and they don't need to sample all of the processes, all of the shifts. We can conduct a sampling to cover everything over the course of those two surveillance audits. And the third year in the cycle represents a recertification audit, which would be a full system audit conducted, again, very similar to the stage two. When we say a full system audit, we're talking sampling of all the processes and the shifts to, again, assess the effectiveness of the system before a new certificate is issued to start that 3 year cycle all over again. With the ability to integrate the management systems, we do see integrated management systems as well as integrated audit contracts. The audits can sometimes be integrated, and in instances where the management system is integrated and the audits are conducted in an integrated manner, there can be discounts for integration applied. However, when an integration discount is applied and the level of integration is found to have been misrelayed, or if the certification body has been misled regarding the level of integration, then we would have been short audit time, and that can pose a challenge. So we do look at integration fairly carefully and on an ongoing basis to monitor for changes to the management system that would affect the level of integration. If you have any questions, feel free to type them into the question field. We will look at those now, but I'm going to skip ahead to the next slide that has my contact information on it. Sometimes questions are more technical in nature or organization specific, that talking outside of the webinar format may be best. So I do want to share my contact information, as well as for anyone who is reviewing this recording or taking a look at the slides themselves, to be able to get in touch with me. I've also included the sales department at PJR, a phone number for that department. If you are a new client pursuing initial certification and you'd like some information on obtaining a quote, that would be a great place to start. Let's see if we have any questions. Okay, so we have a question about integration. If you are already certified to some of the other ISO standards, in this example, it would be ISO 9001 and ISO 14001. If you already have those certifications, what would integration of 45001 look like? So initial certification, those stage one and stage two audits, they would not be integrated that first year unless the stage two is scheduled as an integrated audit with the annual audit requirement for the other standards that you're already maintaining. If the stage one and stage two are performed separately from those annual audits to ISO 9001 and ISO 14001, the 45001 would not be calculated in an integrated manner. However, starting the following year, again, if the audits are scheduled in an integrated manner and the system is integrated, then we could provide a discount for integration. So the integration concept is twofold: whether the management system itself is integrated and whether the audit is integrated. If you do your ISO 9001 management review and internal audit separate from your ISO 45001 internal audit and management review, that's not a fully integrated system. So as I mentioned earlier, we look at how the processes are integrated and then how the audits would be integrated as well. If you have any other questions about integration, if we hold your ISO 9001 and 14001 certificates, you could certainly reach out to your scheduler or salesperson as well to get some detail on how that would impact the contract you already have. I see another question coming through. Is there a supporting standard for auditing 45001? I'm not sure I understand that question. So the standard does have the annex within it with some guidance for implementing the standard. I didn't take the time to go through that during today's webinar, but perhaps your answers would be there. Otherwise, I would recommend maybe you send me an email with some more detail about that question so we can discuss that more offline. I want to be helpful, but I'm not sure I understand. So just in case anyone else is typing, a recording of today's webinar will be made available on PJR's website, as well as a copy of the slides used today. Feel free to refer back to those in the future and use my contact information should you have any questions. I don't see any other questions coming through right now. So thank you for attending today's webinar. Again, my name is Austin Matthews. I'm the EHS Program Manager with Perry Johnson Registrars. If you have an upcoming audit, I hope the content was helpful, and feel free to reach out to me should you have any further questions. Have a great afternoon, and thank you for attending today's webinar.